Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
How you doing, internet? It is Monday, May 14th, and you're listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 156. Pretty sure it's 156. I just checked on that. I am your host, not Austin Walker, but Danielle Riendo. Normally, obviously, Austin does the Monday show, but he is off in a faraway land, a la-la land, if you will. He's in LA doing video game stuff, doing work stuff. And so today, you get me, and you also get Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
Oh, it sounds very hale and hearty today. That was a hale and hearty hello. I like that.
I'm trying. You know, I had an unfortunate family weekend I had to be a part of, and now my kid is sick. So I'm just trying to bring it. I'm just trying to balance out everything else in my life by doing as Austin does, and just finding that energy.
Just powering through. Well, I appreciate that.
I've got my number one dad coffee cup, and I'm ready to go.
Good. That's a good image. That's a very good image to start off the week. Rob, how about you? What kind of coffee cup do you have right now?
I have a pint glass full of water, sadly.
Wait, so is this where, like, okay, hold on, I have a question. So did we revisit the question of the liquids on Friday's podcast? Have we advanced the debate there?
I don't know that we did. I think a lot of other people advanced the debate. I am still really caught up on coffee or water because I love both of them.
Okay, I was wondering if we came to a subtle.
I mean, yes. If I had to actually really choose, it would probably be water. I wouldn't be happy about it. Would not be happy about it. But you do kind of need water to live, so I guess I'm going water. That's it.
So there were. I think anytime we podcast, we generally raise the level of discourse.
True. I didn't mean to suggest otherwise. I was just, you know, especially in this venue, I feel like we were illuminating, you know, putting a spotlight on something that people just don't talk about enough.
Sure.
I think we did. I think people saw our efforts and recognized them for the important contribution to the public discussion that it was. However, I did get the feeling from some feedback that perhaps in some key ways we did not fully know what we were talking about, which is an unusual thing for this podcast. And we never hear that from listeners, but this time we did. And in fact, we may have sort of ended up crossing our wires a little bit with our terminology, drawing a line between clear and colored fluids.
Right.
Because, like, for instance, if your doctor tells you to drink clear fluids, that doesn't necessarily mean that the fluid can't have any color at all. It just needs to be, like, transparent or translucent to light.
It's the amount of light that goes through something. I tried to raise this, and Austin wasn't having it, but I tried to raise that. For the record, tried to raise that.
Austin... I agree. Like, Austin had a very doctrinaire interpretation, an idiosyncratic doctrinaire interpretation of the grounds of debate. But yeah, we perhaps should have been more accurately considering suspensions versus like transparent fluids, like suspensions versus solutions.
Yes. Because also, when it comes to coffee, if you were to say if you make your own coffee and you get the balance wrong on the coffee to water ratio. You can get coffee you can see through, and it's not particularly good coffee or effective coffee, but there's coffee in there, even though you can see through that liquid.
Yes. That's true.
My wife does this constantly.
No one would live like that.
No. No. I do live that way because my wife constantly gets the mixture wrong, and then I have to throw it out and start over. I love you. Happy Mother's Day.
Okay, I have a question. Uh-huh. How does that go over?
Well, you sip the coffee and it doesn't taste like coffee. And I dump it out and, you know, we do a little more impact to the environment, but I get my coffee.
I mean, we all okay. got to make our sacrifices, right?
Mm-hmm. So your wife prepares coffee.
Right.
She goes to the trouble of, like, making a thing yep. for everyone to enjoy.
Yeah.
You take a sip.
Yeah.
And then you... Then you actually let show on your face your distaste.
I've put liquid garbage into my system. I've started my day off on a poor note, and I make sure to pass on the feedback for the future.
And it keeps happening, you say?
Well, like consistently enough that it's an issue. Like it's a feature, not a bug.
Oh boy!
Right. So,
Oh boy.
I'm a little concerned. A couple things.
Please.
It just feels like this is, if it's still happening, is it possible that your performative displeasure at the coffee is actually starting to induce you being served shitty coffee?
Well, she's drinking it too. So that's, I mean.
Okay, but is she drinking it and being like, whatever, this is fine?
Well, I think she has become indoctrinated to the sense that this coffee is acceptable, and what I'm trying to do is...
Did she grow up in around the clock or something?
I'll have to investigate that further.
She's weaned on that kind of coffee.
Yeah. No, I think you're probably being poisoned.
That would explain a lot.
Or headed for divorce, I mean, to be honest.
That would also explain a lot.
Wow.
I mean, look, you're talking to a guy who, like, just took over all coffee duties because, like, look,
oh, no.
It's 75 grams per French press. This isn't hard to parse.
Isn't your partner a physicist?
Yeah, and that's why we have a kitchen scale. That's why we went to weight measurements for everything. Like, she is a scientist, and so, like, you know, a long time ago, she taught me that, like, hey, dumbass, stop using volume measurements for things that aren't, like, liquids, because that's actually highly inaccurate. Use weight measurements. So we have a kitchen scale, but it turns out that I'm very persnickety about... This may shock you. I am persnickety about little things like coffee. It needs to have the exact right grind in the burr grinder settings, and it needs to be 75 grams per French press, and it needs to be exactly 205 degrees.
Oh my god, Rob! Oh my god! I buy big buckets of coffee from Costco and grind it in a weird thing that I don't think does a particularly good job. You would be so...
Yeah, Patrick, just like chowing down and chock full of nuts.
You get like a bead in there, you're fine with it.
Rob would be so upset. Like, I should just take a video for Rob of, like, my process and just watch him.
Ugh. I think if I sorted you out, you and your wife would both agree that my way is best.
I think you're right that we live in a world of ignorance, and I've just chosen to stay behind that veil because it's easier that way.
But at the same time, like, when I, like, look, but the thing I don't do is on those mornings when I don't, like, get up first and I don't get around making the coffee, I am not nearly self-destructive enough to take a sip of the coffee my partner prepared and be like, eh, what's this? This is garbage. Here, honey, let me walk this over to the trash where it belongs and let me put your trash coffee down the drain.
How did you hack into our nest and pick up that direct audio dialogue lift of our mornings, Rob?
Wow. I just buy, like, gallons of cold brew. It's delicious. Grady's Cold Brew, Califia Farms. Oh, that's how
I
live my life.
I've tried so many times to get with cold brew. I just...
It never quite has the
body I want.
Yeah?
So is cold brew just regular? That's not like iced coffee? That's different?
No.
What's the difference?
It's stronger.
Oh, so it's just like...
Yeah. It's also brewed differently.
Oh, okay.
It's brewed like iced tea. So it is...
Oh, wow.
Okay.
You have to take a deep breath before you start this one, Rob?
Wow.
Well, there's a couple ways you can make iced tea. I suppose the preparation is more akin to something like sun tea. But the point is, you take your coffee, you take your coffee grounds, you put them in some sort of like flask or vessel, and you steep it basically cold in a fridge, like overnight, possibly for like 36 hours. I've tried it a couple times, tried it a couple different ways. The idea is that you don't get any, like, you get, like, none of the acid that comes from, like, doing a hot brew. So you get a very mild, creamy coffee, ideally. But I find that it also is very, it's a very thin taste. And so it ends up tasting like kind of what you're describing, Patrick, where it's like there's no good, rich body on this coffee. It's watery. And so I never get with it.
Grady's. Try some Grady's. I'm serious. It's really delicious.
I'm so habitualized to warm coffee that even when it's hot out, I don't even necessarily want to get iced coffee because I just I associate coffee with just warm, like scalding hot coffee. So even like in the summer, I will still occasionally I'll get an iced coffee, but I usually am upset about it halfway through because I'd rather have just gotten the normal coffee that I'm used to.
I prefer iced coffee, actually. I prefer it that way.
Then here's a question. Yeah. Are you one of those weirdos that also likes cold pizza?
No. Oh, okay. Hold on. Now, I need to temper that with I'm from Rhode Island, and we have a delicious treat called bakery pizza. It's not normal pizza. It's not like pizza with cheese. It is room temperature.
It's called cold baking. You just roll out the dough. You put all your toppings on it, and you leave it in the fridge overnight for like 36 hours. And you just eat it.
Look, I want to share with the world what bakery pizza is because very few places actually have it. But it's like room temperature, really delicious, like pizza-y thick bread with like really, truly delicious like tomatoes and sauce on top. And you eat that room temperature. That is not cold pizza. That's not like overnighted pizza that you know, is normally served warm. It is a delicious treat. But normal pizza, no, hell no.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about like you know, you had pizza from the night before, you put it in the fridge in a plastic bag, and then you're like, I'm gonna have some of that pizza tomorrow, and you take it out.
I re-bake
and you
just don't. That.
Yeah, no, yeah, my, no. And my wife, no way. She's like, nah, I'll just eat that stuff.
No.
Yeah, she's a monster. It's delicious.
Oh, so you're one of those too. Oh, I don't understand it. I can't.
No, I mean, look, I love both. Yeah. Like, I am very, like, I'll get very serious about like hot pizza as well. You want to talk about crust recipes? Let's fucking go there.
Yeah.
But no, for by the way, Alice Waters' cookbook has a really good thin crust pizza dough recipe. You should check it out. It bakes up really crispy.
Side note to that is that if you've not made your own pizza before, it is both deeply satisfying and easier than you think, as long as you just go buy pre-made dough from like a whatever, you know, a
That's
Whole Foods
true.
Or
what was I just saying, Patrick?
What?
I give people I tell you exactly where to go for a good dough recipe. That's where you go. Alice Waters cookbook.
But then you have
to just do her pizza dough.
No one's going to do that. You're going to do that, Rob. What I'm saying is that the biggest impediment to making homemade pizza is the dough part, because it's the most time consuming part of it. Whereas if you just go buy some pre-made good dough, then you put your own ingredients on it, it is 1,000 times better than like whatever pizza you will traditionally order. And it's like a really fun way to make some
just
food.
Just make your own sauce is the
I've
thing
wanted
I will
to
say.
Make. I've done the dough thing as well, and it is better. It is a better version of making your own pizza. I'm just saying, if you look at that and go, I don't have the time for that, then I just buy some pre-made dough, but also do the rest of it yourself, and it's still delicious. I'm sorry.
I'm just not sure that. Now I'm not sure your opinion of cold pizza really counts, is the thing. Because you're like, you know, as we all know, the mark of a good pizza is everything but the dough. The dough is expendable. Crust? What does crust have to do with the pizza?
Like, go to the gutter and just like scoop
whatever
you can.
Well, you said go to the supermarket and buy pre-made dough. That basically is the gutter.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right.
Wow.
Well,
like that's like Play-Doh. You roll it out, you put ingredients on it. No.
I mean,
for the
technically,
birds.
The Ninja Turtles ate gutter pizza, right? Because they lived in a sewer.
No, but it was New York. But it was New York delivery.
Yeah, it was. But like they were eating it in a sewer, so doesn't that make it gutter pizza?
Well, the ingredients were fine.
That's true.
Yeah, it never touched.
Unless
I guess it sort
of
did.
Donatello made his own dough, in which case it's literally gutter pizza.
No, they made it like ordering pizza was a plot point in Turtles.
Yeah.
So, like, believe me, like, Donatello at some point, you know, he got into like molecular gastronomy bullshit, right? Where he's like, look at this pizza infusion I made of, you know, Michelangelo's nunchucks or something. I have no idea.
Rob.
But you know, he got into that kind of bullshit.
Rob, I think.
But yeah.
I think you're our Donatello.
I hope not.
Isn't that what Donatello would say, though?
Yes.
I think it is.
Well,
I made some bad life choices. Point is, cold pizza, it's perfectly fine. It's delicious.
I'm not in this instance. I'm not judging. I just don't like cold pizza. I understand. I respect your decision to eat the cold pizza.
I'm not sure you've had enough hangovers, my friend.
Oh, Rob, that is factually inaccurate. As someone with a weak stomach, I have that has been a lifelong problem. Anyway, we should probably 15 minutes in. Maybe
you want to talk about video games?
Yeah, yes. Rob, you've been playing a video game, right? You might as well.
Yeah,
Rob, do you want to just continue on your bullshit for another 10 minutes?
Oh shit! I was even gonna make a whole thing. I had a whole segue plan there with Raphael and Rage. But, like, you know what? I'm gonna let you take that one, Patrick and Rob. You go for it.
What are you guys, some Encyclopedia Britannica? I see. Isn't that what you're playing?
Well, you know, it actually is of a piece with what we've been talking about. Because it is kind of like a not as good as the real thing type of game.
Oh, like cold pizza.
No, so I've been playing, like, this is definitely like the store-bought crust version of Total War.
God damn it.
Total War Saga's Thrones of Britannia, which I've been playing for the last week, and I finally started to sort of really put my thoughts in order about it.
Back up for a second? What is this? Is the sagas like a subgenre of the Total?
Oh, that's a great question.
Because Total War, at this point, is kind of, I've lost the plot on like what that even means, because they've kind of gone in so many directions. So is sagas like a fantasy version? What does sagas mean?
Okay, so the fantasy version is Total War Warhammer,
right,
which is just the inevitable merging of the Total War and Warhammer brands that was going to happen at some point. And it finally did, and it's cool. Maybe it's kind of subsumed the entire series to an extent. Right now, the main game they're working on is Total War Three Kingdoms, which is taking the action to, Three Kingdoms era China during the conflict between, I'm so terrible at remembering the dynasty names.
It was a similar setting to like Romance of the Three Kingdoms.
Oh yeah, for
stuff
sure.
Like that. Okay. All right.
For
so
sure.
There's a touchdown.
Right. So that's the main thing they're working on. That's kind of going to be their next major release. But the thing about the Total War series is they've always had some really good expansions and standalone expansions. So like Empire Total War had a spinoff, which was Napoleon Total War, which just focused on Napoleon's campaigns. Even better was like Rome 2, I don't think was very good, but it gave us a really great standalone expansion, Total War Attila, which was super great about like the final collapse of the Roman Empire. Maybe my favorite one was for Shogun 2. It was Fall of the Samurai, which was kind of like a mix of great Shogun gameplay and then some really good like Gunpowder era Total War stuff. So they already had this tradition of really strong standalone expansions. They just kind of like made that official. And now those are all going to be Total War sagas.
Ah.
And so this is kind of them rolling out that new branding. And I'm curious if it survives this game. Because they kind of poisoned the well right at the start.
What's the setup?
So it is the British Isles during sort of the Viking invasions, before the Norman invasion, before
they
the Norman
also,
conquest.
They did Total War. Didn't they do a Viking game? Was that like the action spinoff that they did? Am I crazy?
Oh shit. Wasn't that a Total War Sparta? They did do an action game ages ago. I'd forgotten
wasn't
about
it
that.
Total
it wasn't very
War
good.
Viking? No, maybe. Okay, maybe not.
Total War Viking Adventures?
No. Anyway, I thought maybe that was... Okay, anyway, continue.
No, this
Sorry.
Has nothing to do with it.
Okay.
They did do a Viking invasion expansion for Medieval 1, which was really good. this one is not very good. And I think a big part of that is they've taken this era and really made it as boring as possible from a strategic point of view. Like, so a Total War game, it's kind of like there's two halves of the game. There's the strategic level and then the tactical battles. And the tactical battles are really flashy and they're gorgeous, and that's what gets all the attention. But what makes them really work is that they're given context and meaning by the strategic level, where you're building up your armies, you're engaging in diplomacy, you're investing in upgrades, and what kind of army you can bring out into the field is determined by that. So it's a little bit like the strategic layer is like GM mode for your empire, and then the battles are the games. In this one, they've basically taken all the meaningful decisions out of the strategic level at all. Like, literally, it's, do you have money for this upgrade? Then you should just do that. Just build that upgrade. Done. That's it. And there's no decisions along that point. It's just build from castle 1 to castle 2. Farm 1 to farm 2. Farm 2 to farm 3. There's no interesting trees that you go along with this stuff. Literally, it's just kind of this linear progression. Research is carried out the same way. And so the strategic layer, you know, it's a gorgeous map. It's a really, like, detailed map of old England, the British Isles during this period. But there's just nothing to do there. And so the battles are fine. But it just feels like half the Total War formula has been blown away here. And so now it's kind of like a really, really thin strategy layer that doesn't really compare at all to previous Total War games. And then sort of the same battle mechanics. But if you break that formula, if the two halves aren't strong, the battles don't really have much meaning because you're just not that invested. And so it's a really frustrating game because, like, it looks great. It runs great. I've had some great battles in it. These are kind of fun little armies. If you like the idea of Viking shield walls clashing with, Saxon axemen and, Welsh archers, there is that stuff. And it is pretty cool. It's cool as hell. But it's all in this context of, like, strategic meaninglessness. And that's kind of the kiss of death for this game. And it's just a huge... This is probably the weakest Total War game I've seen since, like, Rome 2 at launch. And from the standpoint of, like, an actual strategy game design, it's way, way thinner than Rome 2. Like, I'm not sure there's ever been a Total War game this sort of underbaked. As a strategy game.
What do you think happened with this?
Okay, so they're putting out a lot of these, like, you know, relative to where they began, which makes sense because now it's like a big brand that, like, operates under a lot of different umbrellas. But, like, do you think part of underpinning sort of the weakness here is just, like, spreading themselves too thin, like deciding by giving it an official stamp as a spinoff, like, in some ways, like, I wonder if in the past it was like, oh, the reason we're doing this is because we just have too many ideas and, like, let's shove it onto this other thing. And now it's like, oh, now this is going to be something we're putting out every quarter because we, you know, have to hit X amount of releases.
Yeah, I think that goes some of the way to answering Danielle's question of, like, if you look at the blog they posted when they announced Total War Sagas, there's this weird undercurrent of, like, self-conscious branding exercise elements to the entire thing where they're like, well, we're making a bunch of Total War games now and we don't want people to get confused about what's what, so there's going to be Total War games. And then there's going to be Sagas, which will just, they'll still be Total War games. They'll still have all the rich, deep gameplay you love, but they just won't be real Total War games. And the entire blog post has that tone. And I kind of do wonder if that reflects an underlying reality of, you know, it used to be, it always felt like there were two teams working in parallel. There was a team working on the big, like, technologically, like, the big tentpole release that was going to move the series forward, mm-hmm. From, like, a technical and a scale standpoint. And then there was sort of a B team that was going to be developing a new iteration on whatever the, you know, current standard of the Total War engine was going to be, right? So it was like, so there was sort of a breakthrough team and then sort of a, follow-along iterative team. And now it feels like there might be so much happening that maybe there just isn't the same level of care and attention to detail going into these games. Like, this one really does feel like there was not... It feels like, for whatever reason, there was not enough time put into the development of the strategic layer. This feels like somehow a rough outline for how you would tweak the formula for this era. It feels like that just somehow got through and became the final version of the game without ever having really been developed or fleshed out.
I mean, I wonder, you know, it remains fascinating to me that Sega, like, owns this brand and has continued to fund it, because people don't think of Sega as a PC sort of company, and yet, you know, by acquiring Creative Assembly and really getting behind, you know, Total War, like, they've become, like, one of the more prominent, you know, like, underwriters of, like, the, like, forward-facing strategy genre. Like, if you were to, like, you know, think of, like, the major sort of tentpoles, like, Total War is definitely there, and it's weird that Sega's logo is there as well. And I don't know, I think it's, I wonder how much of this is built under, like, well, Sega decided to get really behind, like, strategy games as a thing, and then just as you start expanding those tentpoles and, like, turning it into, like, its own, like, larger umbrella, like, certain things are going to creak along the way as they figure that out. I mean, granted, it's been a while as they've started this expansion, but by sort of, like, formalizing it, I don't know. It remains fascinating to me that you see Sega's logo stamped to it.
It's a little concerning, because, like, so Sega, I mean, they are huge in strategy now. Like, if you're not, like, you should be thinking of them as a strategy publisher at this point, because that has been where most of their emphasis has gone. Like, Creative Assembly is now basically their shop, and they publish the Total War series. I think they're also behind the Football Manager series as well, right? Which is a huge franchise. It flies a little bit below the radar here, but
because it's big in Europe and it's not big here, so people just forget that it exists.
Right. Yeah. Relic was publishing a lot through Sega as well.
Right.
But they sort of hit the skids with Dawn of War 3, which I think, you know, went really, really badly. It was kind of, the vibe I'm getting around that one is it was kind of the Lawbreakers of RTS in some ways. So they canceled development for that. Like, they're done with Dawn of War 3 less than a year after it came out. And now Relic, for whatever reason, is working on Age of Empires 4 from Microsoft without severing their relationship with Sega. It's this, like, contracting out thing. But, like, their future as a strategy game developer is not, it's not very clear right now under Sega, like, what the future holds for them, which is a little bit worrying. And now you see Thrones of Britannia come along, and there's already been a pivot to a lot of DLC and small expansions in the Total War series under Warhammer. And so there's... If you're the sort of person to start, like, getting worried about the moment where capitalism begins to strip mine a property of value. Mm-hmm. I look at Thrones of Britannia and I'm like, uh-oh. I hope this isn't where they've sort of started to poison the series. I think not, like, bad releases happen. I don't want to read too much into this one, and the Total War series has been on a pretty sound footing of late. But, like, this one is a very weak entry in ways that concern me.
Especially for, it'd be one thing if it was like, oh, this is the third entry in the formalized Saga series, but, like, no, this is the foot we're going to put forward now that we're turning in this to an official thing that you can start thinking about and conceptualizing, and we're branding it. Like, that is probably, you know, potentially the worrisome thing. It's like, this is what we thought was how we should start this pivot is with a game that, you know, appears to be a lot weaker than it could have been if it was given a little more time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a good segue into rage, but I guess you could feel rage over that. You could feel, like, a real burning anger.
It's what we associate with Rob.
Speaking
constantly.
Of franchises exploding on the launch pad.
There you go. We got there.
Hey, whatever. Rage had a great shotgun. Come on.
I mean, look, I think I installed Rage and, like, played the opening, and that was it. So, like, I'm actually, like, I'm talking shit about Rage, but it's not coming from a place of, like, being informed about it. So, like, you know, did that game get a bad rap? Like, was Rage secretly way more solid than...
I think there's a case to be made that Rage was better than the reception it got, but I don't know that it gets like a full like revitalization out of that. Like, I've read arguments for that. Like, there's a great piece at Kotaku, written by I forget the author. He's done a bunch of them for Kotaku. And he searched Kotaku, Rage was actually good, and you'll get this piece that makes a pretty articulate argument for the parts of it that are good. And one, I will defend the shotgun to my dying breath. It is a tremendous shotgun, like the quintessential
Doc software. Burford.
Yes, Doc Burford. Yes, yeah. He's done a bunch of great pieces like that for Kotaku and other outlets. And yeah, that's a great piece, and you should go check it out if you want to hear the argument for why that game is interesting. But you know, it was a bad, you know, I think it was pitched as like, you know, id Software making an open world game, and they had never done that before, and that was like very evident in that game, and it had like some really tremendous combat, which is, you know, no great shock given the legacy of that studio. Even if a lot of the, you know, original creatives have left, they've continued to kind of keep that in their DNA. And yeah, so anyway, like that game ends with, I can't remember what the ending is, but it's kind of a wet fart of an ending where it sets up like some big twist for the future. And like, it was clear, like almost immediately after that game came out, that like, you're probably not going to make a sequel to Rage. And yeah, I mean, from the reporting that I've heard, like, you know, id Software was working on a Rage 2, and then they were told to kind of save the like flummoxed Doom project, which, you know, obviously that turned out to be like tremendous. And yeah, so like the last couple of weeks, there have been some indications that Rage 2 is a thing. There was a leak in Walmart Canada where a bunch of retail listings just randomly started publishing games that sounded plausible and both implausible. And the ones that were making people, you know, there's like a Borderlands 3, which, you know, Gearbox has said they're making a Borderlands game. So, you know, no great shock there. But there was an Assassin's Creed game listed. So it was like, oh, all of these seem plausible as games that maybe are about to be announced at E3 or whereabouts. But then you threw in a game like Rage 2, and it's like, why would you make another, no one was, I mean, someone.
Doc There's Bunford a number one Rage fan out there wearing a
there
Rage
was, yeah,
t-shirt.
Doc is out there asking for Rage 2. But there was not, the constituency for Rage 2 was not particularly large or vocal. And so the fact that it was there kind of made people think like, oh, actually maybe this list is, you know, bullshit, and someone was just like having some fun and putting some stuff in the database. But, you know, this morning we got a teaser trailer, and tomorrow we're going to get a gameplay trailer for Rage 2, which is apparently being developed in sort of conjunction with Avalanche Studios. We don't know the exact details of what that means, but that's the studio behind Just Cause and Mad Max. Avalanche has multiple studios in New York and a Swedish studio, so, and this is very kind of a case of like the B team and the A team. So it's like, we're not quite sure what Avalanche's involvement is or which studio is getting involved. I guess if we can say that like if this corroborates the Walmart leak, then Just Cause 4 is probably also getting announced at E3. And there might be a world where you could like start to extrapolate that, well, the team that did 3 was the New York studio, and the team that did Mad Max was the Swedish studio. So probably the studio doing 4 is the New York studio, and the Swedish studio is probably the one working on Rage 2. If that's the case, like, I did not play a lot of Mad Max. We're going to, because we're going to do that for our next Waypoint 101. But that game has its defenders and was like a pretty interesting game from the people that spent time with it. Like, the people that have played it, I've really seemed to like it. And the game they worked on previously was Just Cause 2, which is a phenomenal game, like really, really fun. And so the idea of them applying that sort of expertise in open world and shenanigans, honestly, it's like, I can't think of a better word for Just Cause, like, suddenly makes me interested in Rage 2 in a way that I would not have shown an interest before. And I continue to be sort of like genuinely fascinated by Bethesda's approach to like their brands, which is to say they don't give up on them, even the ones that people would
pray
argue,
to you, baby.
Yep.
It's going to happen.
Or if it did, but here's the thing, if it did happen, like, would you be shocked if it was a completely different game that was not systems driven? It had nothing to do with like the game they made before, other than like the veneer of what Prey, right? That's what I find fascinating about Bethesda as a company, is like, most studios at this point that were like just dragging up old IP, it's like, we're doing another one of those, you would roll your eyes. But at, like, really, at this point, Bethesda deserves the benefit of the doubt. Like, they brought Doom back, and it was great. They brought Wolfenstein back, it was great.
Prey back, and it brought, best game of 2017.
Yeah, yes, Prey was also great. Quake, I didn't play it. It didn't really take off as an esport, so maybe Quake is, you know, maybe one ding against it. But, like, you know, 3 out of 4 ain't bad, and they've basically made the case that they value their IP enough to kind of use that as a reason to, like, experiment and do weird things when they bring them back. And I don't know. It makes me more interested in the Rage 2 than I ever would have been before, because Bethesda has shown a track record where they seem to find ways to make that work.
Now, ZeniMax is privately held, right?
Yes.
Hmm.
Donaldson's brother is on the board of of directors, including Michael Bay, I believe, is also.
That's a weird group of people.
I think that's true. Maybe I think that's true. I might be wrong on that.
It's sort of a matter of public record that, like, Donald Trump hates his brother, right?
Yeah, they don't have a great relationship, and I think there's a reason that his brother hasn't made many public statements about the last couple of years.
Yeah. But I find it interesting that, like, Bethesda aren't giving up on these games. They continue to push sort of these properties that haven't had their breakthrough moment, really. And I just wonder, like, does that entire strategy hang by the thread of, like, well, as long as this ownership group is intact and they're happy to continue, you know, seeing these sorts of returns and taking these kinds of risks, then this is viable. 'Cause it sort of seems like just the direction of the industry as a whole, anywhere a company is publicly held, is to just start getting away from any games that, like, have this sort of risk and return profile and more into what we see, like, an EA doing. And so, like, this would sort of explain why a lot of my favorite games in the last few years have been Bethesda ZeniMax productions, but then also it makes me super nervous.
Well, I guess the thing that probably is, you know, I can't speak to their internal discussions, but at the end of the day, you can always point to, well, Todd Howard's got this coming up, so we're fine. And, like, that kind of, both cynically and realistically, like, that is an interesting part of their business model that we don't know how they think of it. But from the outside, it's, you know, you can look at it and go, well, let's just keep taking. This is what Take-Two has done. Like, Take-Two has taken an extraordinarily long time to get where they are. But for a long time, if you listen to their financial calls, they took a bath every quarter that they weren't releasing a Rockstar game. And every single question from every investor was, hey, what's up with the next Rockstar game? Hey, what's up with the next Rockstar game? Can we expect a Rockstar game next quarter? And their pitch was always, like, basically, like, it's coming. We give them their time. It always pays off. It always gives a return that is, like, well worth the investment of kind of just letting them do their own expensive thing. And then along the way, they were doing these big swings, right? Like BioShock, Borderlands. Like, it's easy to forget that, like, for a while, Take-Two was just the Rockstar company, that they just happened to own Rockstar, and everything else was just kind of floundering. Now you look at Take-Two, and, like, they're a really stable company that's doing a lot of interesting things year after year that is surrounding Rockstar, but Rockstar has just become sort of a foundation, and then they've built these big things over it. And that's what Bethesda has been trying to do, and in a lot of ways failing, because if you do failing from the metric of, was Prey a massive blockbuster success that, like, is going to guarantee a sequel and was a profitable game? Like, no. Like, not the case for Dishonored, but because they always have that kind of waiting in their back pocket, they're able to keep taking these swings. But the also thing that makes them mysterious is because they're privately held, we don't get those Q&As with investors that, like, would inevitably be, hey, where's Todd Howard's game? When is Todd Howard's game coming next? You know, or, you know, when's the next Bethesda Game Studios, like, primary release? And so, like, yeah, they're an interesting company because we don't get a sense of what the rhetoric or, like, the push and pull on that stuff is, because it seems like it's the same dynamic. Like, I really doubt that, or it doesn't seem to be that, like, people are breathing down Todd Howard's neck saying, you know, you got to push to coming out next quarter in a way that's different than, you know, BioWare's relationship with EA, and, you know, Anthem and Mass Effect. And it's just, yeah, it's weird. It's weird in a way that I find really fascinating.
Hold up. Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Speaking of weird and fascinating, we've got some good questions this week. We got a couple, unless we want to talk about any other games that folks have been playing. Anything else that's tickling your fancy at the moment?
All my games are under NDA,
That's
unfortunately.
Right. Yes, yes. I've been playing God of War and Donkey Kong, and I feel like we've probably talked a lot about both of those. So let's go into our question bucket. Of course, if you have questions, you can send them to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. We always appreciate your interesting discussion. So we have a question in here from, let me make sure we get the user here, Evan. Evan writes, "Hi all. The Bloodborne stream the other day began with talk between Natalie and Austin on the tension between work and play. I'm wondering if any of you have experience with the Zachtronic games, like Space Chem and Infinifactory. They're games that are deeply preoccupied with labor, both thematically and mechanically, where much of the pleasure of the games comes from learning relatively simple math, programming, and engineering skills to complete tasks that revolve around industrial production. It's easy to imagine a near future where factory automation produces jobs and requires labor, or requires labor, that isn't dissimilar to what you do in these games for fun. I'm wondering if you have played these games, and if you have further thoughts about the role of play/labor/games and automation intersecting in these modes. Love all that good Waypoint content, Evan." I've played a little bit of Space Chem and really love it, actually. I love puzzle games. I just really like a good, meaty puzzle game, whether I'm good at it or not, whether it takes me a million years to actually figure things out or not. And it's sort of like a calming labor. That's how I sort of think of a lot of puzzle games. It's like a very calming, chill place to put my brain so I'm not anxious about things. It's like the use of them in my life, which I suppose does say something about me in that case. Like, oh yes, working on a really fiddly and sort of complicated thing. Sure, that there's a way of babysitting your brain, I suppose. But yeah, I haven't played Infinifactory. I kind of want to. I'm curious, do you either of you have experience with those games and sort of thoughts on that?
So our producer on Three Moves Ahead, Michael Hermes, is really into these games, and he's tried to sell me on them a couple different times. I think like they scratch a very particular itch for a particular type of gamer, right? Like people who really love mastering intricate, interdependent, connected systems really adore these games. But parsing all of that and seeing how it all fits together is really incredibly daunting for someone like me. And so it's like, to me, I look at these things and I'm like, that looks like basically I'd be taking a class for a week or so before I'm really like playing it competently. And I tend to bounce off of it. Now, I did show this game that they made, Shenzhen IO, which is a circuit building game. A circuit design and engineering game. I showed that to my partner, and I was like, this seems like it's up your alley. And she was like, oh, hell no, because that's my job. Like, I'm not, like, no, that doesn't look fun at all. But then she sort of looked at it, and she's like, but actually it could be. Because it's sort of designed, because the way she put it, the game is sort of designed to, it is a bit like the job, but it's the job on your best day. In mm-hmm. some ways, like, mm-hmm. what if somebody made a game where you're not actually writing, but you're going through the motions of writing, and what you're producing is just really good and really solid and two-spec and two-deadline, and it's performing really well. And all of that happens, and you're just doing an activity that is close to writing, but isn't exactly writing. And that I can actually sort of see being really appealing, because it's like, it's a job simulator of your job at your best, right? It's the intellectual challenge of your work without the stakes and the worry. And I could see that being really satisfying in some weird ways.
You know, yeah. The absolute, like the grind that gets in the way of the actual pleasure of the writing or video editing or, you know, whatever it is that we're doing day to day, like the bullshit, like the, oh, this crappy thing happened or this got in the way or this got in the way and then this got in the way. It's like just this flow state of beautiful work that is just sort of like putting you in that zen state and you're happy to be there. I think it's like the equivalent of
like I play golf. I like playing golf a lot, but I'm like endlessly mediocre at it. But then every once in a while, like you have that like beautiful swing where you put it all together and it's like, ah, that's a world that it would look like if I knew how to do this on a regular basis. But it's a similar thing to what you're talking about there, where like what we do for a living or anyone's living, right? Like anyone's job, like whether it's, you know, games criticism, video editing or writing or being a physicist is like the thing that attracts you to it or the thing that you find satisfying about it, like you probably get to do pretty infrequently, or if you to get into a mm-hmm. mode where you're both doing it well and getting to, like those just moments, they come around every once in a while and then they remind you why you do it in the same way that a good golf swing like reminds you why you struggle through like the eight times that you slice on your way to getting a nine at the end of a hole. But so the idea of like having an experience or a game that lets you just drive and drill into that specific feeling without any of the surrounding stuff, like I can definitely see why that would be satisfying. I have not played either of those games. I am fascinated by like the gifts that get like shared around of them because it looks like the way everything interlocks and fits together.
Opus Magnum is real good for that. It's very giftable.
Right. And I've seen those been like, oh, like, not for me, but, like, it's one of the things you look at and go, I get who this, like, I get why this could be for someone.
Yeah.
Danielle, when you lived in Boston, did you ever make it to the, what was it, the MIT Museum in Cambridge?
I don't think I actually ever went to the museum. I definitely sort of peeked into some of the MIT lab areas from, you know, friends who kind of worked there. So I never actually made it to the museum proper, though, sadly.
It's a small museum. It's cute, but they have this really gorgeous collection of kinetic sculpture.
Oh, and that's my shit. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's basically like kinetic sculpture is basically like, you know, those little perpetual motion machines that people put on their desks and shit like that. And, you know, it's a lot of what you see day to day is kind of like, you know, tacky time wasting stuff. But like in this museum, there are these really gorgeous. They're too elegant to be Rube Goldbergian, but they're similarly intricate and involved, and yet you can sort of parse their function and workings, and they're designed to just sort of you know, function and perform mechanical action ceaselessly to no end other than motion, and so they're all kind of hypnotic, and you can't help but stare at them, and Opus Magnum and like other Zachtronics games seem to sort of scratch that itch, right? Where like I think a lot of people, like, I think what sort of separates Zachtronics to some extent is they make stuff that could be very hard to parse and very kind of bloodless and intellectual, somehow deeply satisfying to watch in motion. That there is some aesthetic quality to the way these games move that gives you an idea of the pleasure of watching, of completing these tasks. Which I find really cool.
Yeah. God, that sounds amazing. I do love that sort of stuff. My nascent understanding of sort of art history and sculpture and the types of art that I didn't actually study in college and grad school is always, God, I always have that feeling of, man, I want to understand this. I want to put my hands on it and I want to understand it because it's incredible and amazing. Awesome. And also now, of course, I need to play Space Jam some more. we have another letter, probably one more, I guess, because the one after that is like 10 paragraphs long, and we're almost at 50 minutes. So let's go with this one. This one comes from Jeremy. Jeremy writes, "BattleTech taught me that the they/them pronoun option in BattleTech. Sorry, the subject line is BattleTech taught me." The letter is, "The they/them pronoun option in BattleTech, along with your coverage of the game, finally pushed me to consider my dismissive attitude towards people who prefer to use neutral pronouns. It's not like I was a Jordan Peterson head before this or had any ill will towards nonconforming folks, but I certainly dismissed their complaints in a way that I now realize is intolerant, reactionary, and completely unhealthy. I was really pleasantly surprised that such a small aspect of this game pushed me to work through this stuff. I wanted to ask if a game had ever made you aware of something ugly in yourself or had a positive impact on an internal struggle that you had. Thanks, Jeremy.
One, that's really good.
Yes.
I want to say, like, yeah. like having, like, personal, like, introspection on stuff like that and, like, recognizing, like, your faults and, like, the ways you can grow and, like, learning to, like, just be more understanding and thoughtful is, like, that's cool. Like, we should recognize, like, you know, often the internet is used to rightfully dunk on people that refuse to do that kind of work. And we should definitely celebrate when people do that work and importantly are willing to admit, like, I had the shitty opinion or said the shitty thing, and, like, here's what I learned and here's where I'm going. Like, that doesn't get you the retweets in the same way that the other stuff does, but yeah. We should definitely be good about like congratulating people, maybe not congratulating, but, like, encouraging people to do the same sorts of things and kind of have the same sort of self-examination.
Well, it's worthy of some congratulation, because a lot of people do, when confronted with that request for empathy and understanding, go the opposite direction and are like,
sure,
hey,
yeah,
fuck you. How dare you make me feel awkward for my beliefs? And then they tell the story of their red pilling.
Yep, exactly.
So, you know,
good job, Jeremy.
I am thrilled to see people go the right direction at that juncture.
You're right. The bar is exceptionally low. So, like, we should be happy with
people. BattleTech showed me Jordan Peterson is a modern luminary.
No. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a game that I had an experience that was anything akin to that.
I can speak, like, as a broad thing. It's not like a game itself, but sort of being in gaming culture was the thing that made me aware of ableist language and, like, trying to, you know, attempt to use less ableist language. That is definitely something that has come from being, like, in, I guess, sort of progressive gaming community spaces. Like, it wasn't one specific game, but it was definitely like, oh, this is something I should try to be less shitty about. You know, like, that's something I should keep in mind and think about and be aware of and not make people feel crappy. With neurodivergence, just not something I... You know, I'm not saying I, like, ran around saying slurs, but I didn't necessarily consider that or think about that until I actually, you know, met a lot of folks in the gaming space who you know, are neurodivergent folks and, like, kind of taught me, like, hey, watch out with what you say, because it actually, like, really hurts people. And, like, there's a lot of meaning there. There's a lot to actually be aware of in that way.
Yeah, I'm in a similar boat where, like, the gaming community is where I have done a lot of, like, personal introspection, like, learned from mistakes, been, like, and, you know, been taught about, you know, not just new ways of thinking, but, you know, re-examining, like, you know, whether it's, like, phrasings of things or stories to look into or communities to examine. Like, a lot of my own personal growth has come from being involved in gaming communities and people having the patience and understanding to sort of, like, help me out as I work through that stuff and learn different things. And so, like, as crummy as a lot of, like, you know, quote unquote video game culture is, like, I'm also deeply thankful for different aspects and different corners of it, because it's helped me do the exact same thing. Like, my entire conceptualizing of you know, feminism, sexism, like, all that stuff that, like, a lot of people, like, go through their, like, 20s, like, learning and, like, just becoming a more empathetic person. Like, that has happened in the context of, like, understanding it through video games and video game culture. And so, like, I, you know, as opposed to having, like, an individual moment in a game, like, it's more been, like, a continual sort of, like, expansion and, like, personal narrative that has happened, like, through video games and video game culture that I'm deeply thankful for.
Yeah.
So I think for me there's a couple things. I remember back around the time that it was announced or revealed that you were going to have the option to make Shepard in Mass Effect gay. I think, was that... Because, like, you could... Well, always, you can... Like, Liara was always Shepard, was always, like, bisexual and oriented to Shepard. Like,
yes.
Canonically, she's supposed to be your wife at the end of Mass Effect, I suspect. But beyond that, I don't think you could. There were same-sex couplings available to Shepard. Were there prior to?
So three was the first one you could be a dude and date another dude.
Right.
I believe so. In two, you could go on a date as a lady Shepard. You could go on a date with your like assistant, your ship's assistant lady.
Right.
But it was pretty like surface level, for sure. So.
Because I remember at the time being resistant to that more because it felt to me like at the time I interpreted it as like a bit of like hollow feeling inclusivity. Because I was like, we're three games into this. This is a pretty significant retcon for a character that this hasn't been part of their identity. And that would sort of seem to be running counter to who Shepard is and has been. And I think I was sort of up my own ass about that a little bit. And then I started to see that both the reaction to it, but then also the way it was executed. And by the way, I hear that Caden has a fascinating arc in light of how that evolves over the course of the series. But I think what it was a game that made me realize that I tended to think that fiction that includes marginalized people should somehow speak to their daily experience, like here in our reality. And it started to make me realize that, like, oh, wait, there's actually a really good case to be made for not having all the shitty things about our modern context reflected in every piece of fucking fiction you consume. And imagine how exhausting it would be to see yourself constantly portrayed as somehow other or somehow victimized or oppressed. Like, I started to see the value in fiction that is not even necessarily empowering, but more liberating from that context.
Yeah.
And I'd always been really dismissive of that. But like Mass Effect kind of snapped me out of that and is like, no, not every gay character in a game has to have a gay story by the standards of like 1990s American pop culture,
right.
For instance, right? Where it's like, well, I think we all learned something. In the space adventure.
The coming out story / bullying story.
Right.
Basically. Yeah.
Right.
or in the case of a lot of like queer narratives about women, somebody dies. Almost mm-hmm. always. Like, especially in like 90s and 80s and prior to that, somebody dies. Somebody commits suicide. Sorry, content warning for all of that shit. But like, that was such a trope.
But it's,
like,
yeah.
Yeah. Like such a prevalent trope. Yeah. That's really cool. We talked a little bit last week about Mass Effect and why I loved it because it was gay. So, like, you know, my heart is warmed by the fact that Mass Effect was special in that way for you too, Rob. I mean, not in the same way, but you know what I mean. Oh, amazing. I think we've all learned something here today. I guess we all have.
I mean, we learned a lot about Patrick.
We learned a lot about Patrick. We learned a lot about coffee.
You're welcome.
You know, yes. Thank you. Thank you for being a friend. Thank you, everyone. For being a friend, for being here.
It's weird all queer. Patrick's lessons about empathy haven't translated to the breakfast table.
Oh, boy. See? Wow. That's your next lesson, Patrick.
Maybe you need to learn some empathy for me, Rob, and what I'm going through.
Oh. I don't know. I think we just started.
You haven't tasted that coffee, Rob.
I think I have. You know what I mean? Like, you describe it, and I'm like, I think I know that coffee. I think I know that brew.
We've all tasted the bitter taste of oppression coffee, I feel like, mm-hmm. a little bit, you know. So if you have questions, of course, dear friends, you can send those to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. Shoutouts, as always, to Bowen for letting us use
We gotta do
track.
Our waypoints.
Oh, waypoints. Shit, I almost forgot about our waypoints. How could I? I'm sorry. I was so distracted by Mass Effect and coffee. Patrick, what's your waypoint this week? What's your waypoint?
I'm going to shout out because this got unexpectedly popular on Twitter last week. Related to Rage 2, I wrote a short post for an open thread on Waypoint about if Rage 2 can exist. I was trying to go through a list of games that, like, if you just attached a 2 to it and announced a sequel, people would do the same sort of head fake as Rage where it's like, what? So it was like not obvious stuff. Like I was going through my list of games I want sequels for, and it's like Bully 2, like, has been rumored forever. So it's like it would be surprising, but not in the same sort of like, why would they do that? You would go Bully 2 and go, oh, because people really liked that game. And so the one that I kind of landed on was a sequel to Prince of Persia from 2008, which was had this really incredible look. They used cel-shaded as shorthand, but, you know, it looked, you know, kind of like an animated cartoon. It had this really interesting mechanic where you couldn't die, and it wasn't that you couldn't die, it's just that when you missed a jump or something like that, it just rewound you back to the previous thing you were doing. So all it was doing was just skipping the game over screen and just bringing you back to where you were. And it caused a lot of weird controversy at the time. I haven't gone back to that game, so I'm sure my feelings about it would be a little bit different. It was a instance where Ubisoft sold the real ending as paid DLC. Bad. But it was one of those games that I so deeply wanted to see a sequel to. There was something about it that really resonated with me. And there was just a lot of really creative ideas, and it's so I'm going to champion going back and checking out a game that I can't 100% vouch for. Prince of Persia 2008, which I believe you can also get on Steam. It has not gotten any sort of remaster, unfortunately. You can get the version of it on PC, where apparently I looked, they didn't even release the DLC for.
What?
So the real ending that you had to pay for apparently is not even available on the PC version, which also bad. But wow. Yeah, I'm gonna champion the Prince of Persia 2008. A game I desperately wish got a sequel, but will never happen. But maybe if I scream loud enough, it'll get some sort of backwards compatibility at some point so people can check it out.
Oh, I want to play that again, for sure. My God. Rob, what about you? What's a good waypoint for you this week?
I think given the events of last week, watch The Expanse, people. God damn it. Like, go on Amazon. Like, the first two seasons are free on Prime. Start ordering up that third season. I haven't started it, actually, because I've been backlogged with... Well, I've been watching a lot of playoff basketball and hockey, but I'm ready to start season 3 of The Expanse. I just finished my rewatch of season 2. The Expanse is a great goddamn show. And it's gotten, again, like, it's one of those things that has gotten, like, more resonant with time. It creates a really interesting political landscape for its universe and different competing interests and the tensions that exist within movements and political bodies, organizations in that universe. And it's all done via this really genuinely exciting, thrilling, and gorgeous sci-fi drama. It's got this incredible cast, but I think watching the second season of The Expanse really started to drive home how much my view of the character's politics has changed in the last couple years. Particularly, and again, I haven't gotten into the third season, I haven't read the books, but there is this character, Dawes, that is sort of this extremist leader of the sort of the laboring classes of this universe, the Belters, the people who live in mining colonies out in the asteroid belt and beyond. And they've historically sort of been taken advantage of by sort of militaristic Mars and uber capitalist wealthy Earth.
Yeah.
And so this character Dawes, there's this great showdown about midway through the season between the factions of Belter leadership. And there's this character, Fred Johnson, who is sort of representing the moderate wing of the movement, who's like, the time has come to reach a good, equitable settlement with Mars and Earth, and that should be our strategy. We hold all the cards right now. We should take advantage of this moment to make them treat us fairly. And this character Dawes comes along, and he gives this great speech about the different values that the various factions have and why any agreement with people like the militarists of Mars and the incredibly acquisitive, greedy, leadership on Earth, why any agreement with them is going to be sort of self-defeating and dangerous over the long haul. And therefore the real play here is to sort of grab them by the throat and squeeze whatever concessions you can out of them. Like, press really hard, no compromise. And when that scene first aired, I was like, oh, clearly, like, Dawes is a snake in the grass, right? Like, this guy, what a scumbag. Like, he's coming along, getting all these people riled up and creating, like, a really crisis of leadership within this movement just at the moment that a fair deal could be on the table. And watching it now, I'm like, and Dawes might actually have the clearest vision of the state of play in this universe. Like, he might be right. And it's interesting to me that, like, the series politics bears that sort of scrutiny, right? Like, a lot of sci-fi can date, you can sort of date itself by, like, what its clear politics are. I think The Expanse is really cool because, like, at the end of a lot of these debates and a lot of the things these characters have to go through, I'm left with a lot of empathy for every single player on the board. Like, it unfolds tragically because everybody is making a lot of, like, relatable decisions for reasons that make sense. And your view on them will change a lot depending on where you stand and what you're concerned about at that point in your life. So it's really, really cool. It was canceled by Sci-Fi. I don't know if that means the series is canceled. Right now, things look very iffy. But either way, you should dig into it because those first two seasons are tremendous.
God, they are. Reading the books now, I have been in awe of how good the show is, actually. I love the books as well, but the show is a really concise and improved version, I think, of a lot of the things that happen in the books. And holy crap, it is, especially James Holden is a lot better in the show than he is in the books. But yeah, co-signed that one times 1,000. Please, somebody, Netflix, I don't care, somebody pick up The Expanse and make the rest of it.
Oh, wow.
Fantastic.
I'm reading the Deadline article. Apparently, it's written by the writers behind Children of Men, which explains a lot.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. My waypoint this week is really fucking goofy. I went to a Eurovision party this weekend, and I went really late. I actually missed Eurovision. But my friends and I put on 1999's best movie about a mummy, The Mummy, and we sure watched Brendan Fraser in his greatest glory, in his Brendan Fraserist.
Well, that's not Blast from the Past.
Oh, yeah. That movie is kind of great in that it knows it's a piece of fucking trash, but it has a lot
also,
of fun
Brendan
anyway.
Fraser, kind of great.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly. He was hot and earnest and, like, adorable in a lot of the right ways, in the ways that I remember my local critic in the Providence, Rhode Island, the newspaper, the local newspaper, called him a bargain basement Indiana Jones. And I will never forget that. I will never forget that he called, his character Rick McConnell in this movie, bargain basement Indiana Jones, which actually kind of gets at the character quite well, but it's missing a lot of the charm and the, like, happy, goofy smile of the character. The movie itself is, like, a really weird mishmash of horror and, like, slapstick comedy and screwball comedy, which I did not realize, huh, you know, since watching it, you know, for the first time as, like,
screwball?
Yeah, there's a lot of screwball in this between Rick and what's-her-face? Rachel Weisz's character, who is, like, adorable. They have these, like, long take scene, like single shot scenes that go on for minutes and minutes, where they're doing slapstick kind of screwball stuff, where they're talking
a lot of his comedy was very physical.
Yeah,
like he's kind of a big goofy looking guy.
Yeah, and
so that's not super shy. There's I can't remember, people have to look it up, but someone did he's had like a rough go of it.
It was
like
a
10
GQ
years or so.
Profile, I think.
Yeah, there's this GQ pro. There's both. Famously, some interview where he was at like Cannes or something like that, where someone asked him like how things are going, and it was just like super sad
he
and
was
upsetting.
Yeah.
And he was like very honest about how like the directions his career has taken. And then there's a GQ profile from last year, I think, where they went out to like his ranch or farm and did this really fascinating profile of like, you know, just where he's at and the kind of person he sounds like. He's much more at peace with where he's at, and it was just you know, a lot of profiles don't really tell you that much about a person, but that one was particularly insightful and made you want to root for him and hope that, you know, things kind of go his way. I mean, certainly he seems like he's fine. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like he's not slumming it necessarily, but he's just the way Hollywood kind of cycles people in and out. It's a sort of fascinating look at where he ended up.
And it's worth noting he was harassed, I think, as well, like sexually harassed by a male producer. So, like, he's had a shitty time, this mm-hmm. dude. Like, he is definitely, I think he is, like, in some new projects. It sounded like there was some life to, you know, to celebrate in his career. But also, he's really, really charming to watch, especially, you know, kind of in the prime of the late 90s, early 2000s, when he was making a lot of movies. Not all of them were good or even decent, but he sure was a fun dude to watch.
And I will argue for Blast from the Past. I will say that is a good movie.
Hell yeah!
You know, I watched so much Airheads as a kid. Oh my! Like I was, it was always on Comedy Central. It's probably still is. It was like a mainstay of back when Comedy Central like was just like putting on all these comedies all day long that they were snatching up for syndication. But I watched it. I grew up basically with Brendan Fraser. Like I watched, Blast from the Past,
Encino Man,
classic. Airheads. Like I genuinely loved growing up. I am here for Brendan Fraser. Yes. Let me tell you,
100%. Also, the guy who plays Imhotep, really hot. Not something I realized when I, you know, back when I was like 15 and watching this movie for the first time. The like bad guy who you know is the mummy, really hot dude. Just gonna put it out there. You know, if you're in the mood for that. That's it's there for you. So yeah, The Mummy, pretty fun movie, pretty fun. 1999. All right, I think those are all our waypoints for today. Of course, shout out to Bowen letting us use his track "Miss You" off of the EP Pale Machine. We're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice as well. And of course, you can read all of our wonderful articles at waypoint.vice.com. Patrick, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at Patrick Lubick.
Amazing. Rob, how about you?
At Rob Zachney.
Awesome. I'm at Danielle R.I., and I'm here to tell you, be good and be good at it.
So the thing is, you want the coffee at 205 degrees because that, like, any hotter, it gets, like, burnt. But any colder, it just no body on it. It's a very thin coffee, the kind that Patrick's wife makes.
Oh, baby.